So, as many of you know, Tara and her husband Jonathan are away teaching IMCW's spring retreat, and without the other's knowledge, they both asked me on the same week to teach their classes. And Tara and Jonathan told me that they have a lot of what they call double dippers, which is people who go to both. Anybody here a double dipper? Just curious? Oh, somebody in the back? Okay. So that I wouldn't do the same talk twice, and just to challenge myself with that, I decided to do a theme, and I based my, and by the way, the other one will be on the podcast, so if you want to hear the first one, this is the second one, but I based my theme on this favorite quote of mine from Pema Chodron, who tells us, "The Dharma that is taught and the Dharma that is experienced are descriptions of how to live, how to use your life to wake you up rather than put you to sleep. And if you choose to spend the rest of your life trying to find out what awake means and what asleep means, I think you might attain enlightenment." So you can tell them what my theme is going to be a little, yeah? So at Monday, I talked about how we can find what asleep means a little bit more in a more literal way when we can't seem to relax or fall asleep. And tonight I want to talk about the exact opposite of this, which is how to find out what awake means and avoid what in the Buddhist teachings is called sloth and torpor. And I love that term. I think I laughed the first time I heard sloth and torpor. Just kind of sounds funny. And I can very vividly recall the first time I experienced this sloth and torpor in practice, which was about 30 years ago or so now. I was in my early 20s, and I was just starting to study meditation at Naropa University in Boulder, Colorado. And I was very blessed there to be able to learn meditation from the teachers and the monks and nuns who taught there and visited there and go to retreat right at the university. It was really nice and convenient. And at the time, in my 20s, I was newly in love at the time with my husband, who's still my husband now, man who would become my husband. He was my boyfriend back then. And he lived about 45 minutes away from Boulder in Denver, Colorado. And so I was traveling back and forth from school to his place, if you can imagine, usually on the weekends, and then studying and taking classes for a master's degree in writing at school. And so I was, if you can imagine, I was just really tired a lot of the time. And during this time, the school was offering a retreat on a Saturday with this really popular monk that to this day I'm really super embarrassed. I can't remember his name, but what I do remember is that I really wanted to go because I didn't want to spend the weekend with my boyfriend. I really wanted to go to this retreat. So instead of spending time with Brent, I got up early in the morning from Denver at a crazy early hour for some reason that I will not ever understand. I almost always want to complain about it, but I don't. Is Buddhist meditation teachers, the more traditional ones, want to start us at 5 in the morning all the time. And I'm not down with that. And I was just on a monastic retreat where they had us getting up at 5 every morning. And to make it even more fun, the Buddhists also don't agree with coffee. And so same thing happened on this retreat at school. There was no coffee. It was exhausting. And I couldn't seem to stay awake. And I was embarrassed because I kept kind of doing that nod thing, you know, where you're doing that, which is the nod. So I decided to just take a quick nap outside on one of the couches in the lobby. And it's sort of similar to this. It's kind of like everybody's in the sanctuary and then there's a couch, you know, maybe out there. I think there actually is one out there. So it was right there. And I recall lying down on this couch and being sort of lulled to sleep by the meditation instructions of our teacher, you know, who I could hear very clearly. And what I remember next is being woken up by this sudden eruption of giggles from all of my classmates. 100 of my classmates were giggling. And as their giggling started to subside, what I recognized with some degree of horror was they were laughing because I had farted myself awake. Really loudly. So even in my stupor, I heard that. It was that loud. Not one of my finer moments. But what I also remember very vividly is this very kind monk who kind of walked out into the lobby, took a hold of my hands, and very gently told me that the best meditation for me that day was to probably go home and give myself a long nap. And so I'm so grateful to him, actually, for his kindness, A, but also for his advice, which is what I've been giving my own students now for years, because it's true, which is we cannot meditate well when we're battling with fatigue. We just can't, you know? And sometimes, honestly, the best thing to do if you're on retreat is to try to take a nap, though not near or in the meditation hall. Or honestly, just I've told some people, you know what, just like the monk did, you really need to go home. You're not going to make it through the day. You're too tired. Just go home. Try again. The Dalai Lama himself has said, sleep is the most common meditation for everyone. The most common meditation, even for birds, he says. It's the most important meditation. This is from the Dalai Lama. Not for nirvana, but for survival. And this issue of sleep is such a common struggle in meditation practice in particular. Anybody else show of hands falls asleep at meditation or gets sleepy? Almost everybody? Yeah. So it's so common that after retreat, usually I open it up to Q&A, and I can only give kind of short answers about this, usually some quick tips on how to do it, which is frustrating for me. So tonight, I wanted to go into it a little more and offer you some suggestions to help you explore staying awake, not only during practice, you know, but in our lives, right? So to better understand how we can wake up physically and mentally, how do we use our practice to do this? And what I find really interesting about those who are unfamiliar with the teachings is that people think that meditation itself is a form of sloth, right? It's like, to the outside eye, it seems like we're just sitting here doing nothing. You know, we're just trying to relax or bliss out, you know. People sometimes say to me when I'm going on a retreat, oh, have a really good time. Those of you who have done it before know that that's not always how it goes. True meditation practice can help us to overcome sloth and torpor, okay? A few years ago, there's this great clinical study that tracked about 50 people who had moderate sleep problems, and half of them took a course where everyone learned the traditional healthy sleep habits, like going to bed at the same time, you know, not eating before bed, all those traditional things that they tell you. The other half took a class on mindfulness meditation, what we're doing here. And when they compared the two groups, those in the mindfulness group ended up having significantly less insomnia and fatigue and depression. And as a result, they had much better quality of sleep. What I found interesting was that the researchers also found that not only did mindfulness help reduce sleep problems, the beneficial effects of that carried over into reducing daytime fatigue and depression. Jon Kabat-Zinn, the founder of mindfulness-based stress reduction, calls this practice that we're doing falling awake. I love that, falling awake. He says, the essence of mindfulness practice is to work at waking up from the self-imposed half-sleep of unawareness in which we are so often immersed. And many of you know in the Buddhist teachings, this kind of sleepiness is considered one of the five hindrances, right? The things that hinder our practice and hinder happiness and joy in our lives, along with aversion, right? Grasping, worry and restlessness, and doubt. I won't go into those all tonight. But this hindrance, as with almost everything else in the Buddhist teachings, is broken down into even more parts. And so this one is described as two different but related things. Sloth and torpor are not the same thing. Okay? So the term sloth is more on the sleepiness side. Just saw somebody yawn. I love it. All right. It's more on the sleepiness side of this hindrance because it manifests in the body as a physical experience, right? So, for instance, so you might, when you're thinking of sloth, think of the actual animal, right? The body of that animal, for the body. So it might feel heavy and sluggish, lethargic, weary, maybe weak, maybe like we're sunk in the mud, okay? That's sloth. Torpor, on the other hand, relates to a kind of sleepiness in the mind, okay? And it manifests as a lack of mental energy. So when we're experiencing torpor, the mind can also feel heavy, or maybe like it's wrapped up in a heavy, wet blanket, or it can feel dull or weary or thick. Okay? Torpor can also feel like a state of being lost in the clouds, right? We keep drifting in and out of thought like we're daydreaming. That's torpor still. Or when we're drifting into sleep or half sleep, we're kind of just sort of half there. That's torpor. Torpor also includes a sense of, sometimes a sense of nothingness, sort of like a blank state, right? Like the mind is almost opaque without a clear awareness. The teacher Heidi Born describes the state of mind as like hard butter that's hard to spread, okay? And before I offer some practical suggestions for how we can work with sloth and torpor, I want to go over four main reasons why we tend to let this hindrance take us over. And actually, the good news is that just knowing about these and recognizing them is the first step, okay? So the first reason is something that might seem completely obvious, but honestly, it's something we don't often recognize or even acknowledge, which is that we're tired. You know, more often than not, we're tired because we're overly stressed and busy, but we don't notice this because the state has become a kind of normal for us, right? It's just, we don't even remember what relaxed feels like because we're always in that high adrenaline, go, 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 gotta go, gotta get done, whatever it is. And when it feels normal, we don't recognize the toll that it's taking on our body until we actually sit down and decide to agree to listen to it, right? When we sit down then in practice and we close our eyes and we allow our thinking minds to quiet, the body responds sometimes by saying, oh, thank God, finally, some time to sleep. You know, thank you. Again, maybe, you know, most of us are familiar with what's called the nod, you know. And to help you feel better, it happens to all of us, every one of us. I have some really good stories about that, but I'll tell you one, which is a few years ago, I was up practicing in Massachusetts, where I go a lot. And I was sitting in the sanctuary one afternoon after a very long sit. On this particular retreat, you didn't have to stop at a particular time. You could keep going. And so this had been, I think, about an hour and a half. And most of the other students had gotten up to leave. And I was on retreat with one of my very favorite monks in the world, Bhikkhu Anayo, great scholar and writer. And since I was having such a good sit, and I didn't feel like leaving yet, I thought, okay, I'm going to try to stay here until Bhikkhu Anayo stands up and leaves, because he was always the last one to leave the hall. And as I was sitting, of course, I kept kind of opening one eye. and is he still there? Is he still sitting? And thinking how grateful I was the whole time, just my heart was kind of beaming about, you know, how grateful I was to be sitting and studying with this great, skilled master. I was sitting there, kind of keep my eyes, and then I saw him do this. So so happy. I was like, hallelujah, my teacher is human. Like, he did the nod, and I just felt so much better about myself. I also realized with some compassion that he had great reason to be tired. It was, 2 weeks into a pretty intense retreat of about 100 of us. But I'm sharing that story in hopes that it will remind you to be super kind to yourself whenever you find yourself falling asleep during meditation. Because we can beat up on ourselves so much, can't we? Why am I so tired? Why can't I do it? Why am I falling asleep? Just remember, we all do it. Your falling asleep should never be something that, you beat yourself up about or even be embarrassed about, unless you wake everybody up with your farting, then you can be a little embarrassed. But so that's the first reason that we start to feel sleepy during meditation. We're just tired and our minds and bodies need rest. Really important, okay? The second reason is that as we're training our minds to go into deeper brainwave states, as we practice, I won't go into these states tonight, but as we deepen our practice, this happens more and more, and it happens more easily, is that we go into deeper brainwave states. And in the beginning, when we're just starting to practice, as we're learning to transition to the calmer, deeper wave-like states, what happens is that our minds tend to get drowsy as we go deeper, and we might want to just go right to sleep into those brainwave states. We're not used to to being awake and relaxed. So mind just wants to go to sleep. Sometimes students will tell me that what they experienced felt deeply relaxing, but they felt like they were away somewhere until they came back. In reality, what they were doing was sleeping, right? It's a form of sleep or a form of going away, even as a way to avoid being present. It's like a glass of wine, like I'm just going to slip away here into nothingness. You're not practicing. You're not practicing Vipassana insight meditation here. And sometimes it's actual sleep, which we can detect because they're snoring, usually. So the truth is, whenever you think you were asleep, you probably were, in one way or another. And the idea is, as we enter those calmer brainwave states and calmer states of body, we're training our minds and our bodies actually to be more awake in our daily lives, more clear and lucid and present, except with much, much more calm and ease and balance. That's what we're training ourselves to do if we can stay awake during our practice. So it just takes some practice to be able to start to access those deeper, calmer states without also falling asleep. As our practice deepens even more, we also become more acclimated to letting go of our mental habit of constantly wanting, not wanting, rejecting all the constant stimulation, distraction of our mental activity. Okay? And in time, we start to recognize more and more that we can rest in awareness itself. And that awareness that we're resting in is vivid and clear, in a place of deep calm. We've agreed to give up our mental caffeine and be awake without it. Ajahn Brahma Vaso has a beautiful way of describing how we want to practice. It says, the mind has two main functions, doing and knowing. Doing and knowing. The way of meditation is to calm the doing to complete tranquility while maintaining the knowing. Sloth and torpor occur when one carelessly calms both the doing and the knowing, unable to distinguish between them. Okay? So when we're sitting, we're practicing to calm the doing, not the knowing. Don't calm the knowing. If you've let go of the knowing, again, you're not meditating, okay? You're asleep and you're not helping yourself find wakefulness. Okay, so that's the second. The third reason that we experience sloth and torpor during practice is because as we're practicing to open up to what's here in our mind and our heart, allowing our thoughts and emotions to just be here without suppressing them or judging them, sometimes what happens is that something we've been holding under the surface, not wanting to look at, or maybe not even wanting to acknowledge, sometimes that starts to rise up into our consciousness. And I like to think of it as like you're holding a beach ball under the ocean, trying to pretend you're not. Nothing to see here. I'm cool. I'm not stressed, right? And in meditation practice, when you let go, that stuff might start coming up, and the beach ball, instead of being feeling this big, might feel as big as this room. It's too much, right? So our mind at that moment decides it needs to help us with a little mental narcolepsy. Not now, I'm going to sleep now, right? And of course, this can happen in our daily lives too, when we don't want to do something. Maybe write a paper or do some project or some chore we've been putting off. Or maybe we need to meet with someone we don't really want to meet with or have that confrontation, whatever it is. Suddenly, we just get really, really tired. Notice that. Notice it. It's an unconscious form of resistance or even a way of reluctance, right? And there's a very famous parable in the Buddhist teachings that speak to this, and it's about a man who is shot with a poisoned arrow. And as he's lying there dying with this poisoned arrow, he refuses to let those who have gathered around him save him by removing this poisoned arrow until they can answer all these questions. Who shot the arrow? What direction did it come from? What tribe or archer did the arrow belong to? You know, how was the poison made? What ingredients did it contain? What type of bird feather was the arrow made of, et cetera, et cetera? And of course, the man would be dead before all the questions could be answered. So the question we have to ask ourselves is, why would he do it? Why would a man do that? He's dying. Why would he do that? And here you have to think about that arrow, right? The arrow goes in really quickly, but because it has two barbed edges, it's a painful and messy process to cut it out. So in our own practice, when we're faced with something within us that's painful or difficult, maybe even something that feels like it's killing us, we might start trying to figure it all out by psychoanalyzing everything. Right? Or maybe we nod off or numb out. We go to sleep in some way. And this can include maybe getting depressed, giving up in some way as a way to avoid the pain. So all of these are strategies, ways that we're trying to avoid ourselves in our practice and the pain we might need to feel, which may be a slow and painful process, just like cutting out that arrow. Right? And so this is the type of sloth and torpor that we can easily fall into. Instead of meeting whatever it is head on and making a sincere effort, you know, to find out from our own effort, from our own practice experientially, what the teachings are trying to show us. Okay? Because the truth is, if we aren't willing to face it, that arrow is going to stay stuck in us. And it's going to fester. And it's going to get even more painful. And whatever it is we need to do won't ever get done. And sadly, this often means we never fully heal or transform even, because we're not willing to deal with the arrow, right? And that's so much a part of the practice. And again, one of the reasons we fall asleep. We don't want to look at it. So you can look at all the ways, think about ways that you might start noticing, ways, we all have different ways of doing this. They can be subtle and they can be really big. Which leads me to the fourth reason that we experience physical and mental sleepiness during practice, which is related. And this includes how our own minds are interpreting our practice or ourselves. So these states of mind can look like thoughts that resemble discouragement, frustration, sense of hopelessness, maybe boredom or feeling indifferent, okay? How we're relating. Boredom, for instance, is a really common reason why we fall into sloth and torpor. And it comes from a constant need for everything to be exciting and new and active, right? But nothing in itself is inherently boring. It's simply, boredom is another form of judgment. This is boring. And who's saying it's boring, right? It's a judgment. And it's an activity of the mind. The teacher Gil Fronsdell, who I love, suggests that boredom actually arises from a kind of self-identity. He says, people who feel highly energized when their self-image is being enhanced or diminished may deem an experience boring if it does nothing for their self-image. Right? So it's kind of like that, I'm bored, what's in it for me? And we can start checking that out. What's in it for me? I'm bored. And with this one, when we're feeling bored, we can start looking at mental attitudes like striving, which actually, interesting, paradoxically, keep us from going deeper into the practice. And so we might ask ourselves, for instance, when we're practicing, am I wanting something or myself to be different? Am I wanting something or myself to be different? Or am I wanting something to happen? The first time I meditated ever by myself, I really thought I was going to hallucinate or float or something, right? I was waiting for something to happen. Nothing happens. Right? Or am I wanting a different state of being? I don't like how I am right now. I want a different state of being. Maybe a more exciting meditation. And if you want a more exciting meditation, the second question might be, what would that look like? Right? And really question that. Some other mental states that can lull us into sloth and torpor are things like feeling discouraged, right? And with this one, we might notice we're having thoughts like, it's too hard. I can't do it. It's too much. And here again, the practice becomes learning to see these thoughts as they arise, notice how they're affecting the body, and most importantly, question their validity. Okay? Question their validity. Another probably more subtle cause of sloth and torpor can be the opposite of that, which is complacency. And this is when we start to feel like our practice is so easy and it's so comfortable and we get that happy, warm, fuzzy feeling like a nice glass of wine that just wants to lull us to sleep, right? And this is when you need a powerful Zen master to come around with her awakening stick to whack you on the shoulder to wake you up. Anybody experiencing those ever? This is really a thing. It's called a kaisaku, and I've personally been whacked with one, very gently. It's actually called an awakening stick or a warning stick. My favorite is it's an encouragement stick. And last year, actually, during a really particularly challenging day-long retreat I was offering, there's over 100 people there, and my retreat manager and I could not for the life of us find out who was snoring. The whole set, we couldn't find this person. And the retreat was on anger, which is so funny because the person was making everybody really pissed. We couldn't find it. So I gave her a version of a keisaku stick, an awakening stick. And we announced this at every retreat now. And nobody's ever snored now. I think the threat of it has solved that problem. So, and it is, it's just encouragement, right? Just to see it. And so with some more gentle encouragement, I want to offer you a few ways that we can practice practically with sloth and torpor. And again, as an initial encouragement, I want to remind you of the Dalai Lama's advice, which is that the most important meditation truly is our sleep, right? If we're not getting enough of it, our meditation practice is not going to be as helpful to us, right? On the other hand, we can also use our practice to really notice and acknowledge how sleep deprived we are, right? You know, and notice if it's just physical sleep that we need and not something that's, we're not that we're sleepy for more of a psychological reason. Although, of course, the two ride together. They can. So, for instance, sometimes at night, I'm a night owl. I start my set at 10:30 and I end at 11:30. Sometimes when I sit down to meditate, what I'll discover is that my body's just really tired, which it probably will be tonight. I'll probably skip my sit. Instead of continuing to sit, if I notice that my body is tired for another 45 minutes or so, I'll just let myself stay, maybe for another 5 minutes. And since I recognize my body's just tired, and work more on the calming aspect of practice, which is to maybe use a mantra or the metta practice, which I offered tonight, really simple, to start getting my mind and body ready for sleep. When I recognize I just need to sleep, I won't go the rest of the time. I'll give myself that. So that's an option. Don't torture yourself. Make yourself even more tired. Again, other times we can use the experience of actual physical sleepiness as a way to practice investigating what sleepiness feels like in the body, right? Explore it. Is it heavy? Does it feel like a fog or a wet blanket? Does it come in waves? You know, where do I feel it? Where does it live in my body? You know, where, maybe it's, sometimes I have a headache, lives there, or my shoulders feel tight, or maybe it's in my tummy, or my legs. Notice, where does it live? And the good news is it's possible to experience physical sleepiness while maintaining a clear mind, right? It's actually very similar to working with pain. Those of you know how to work with pain in practice. It's the practice of this is just it. This is pain, right? And we explore it. We just like energy moving through the body. So same concept. This is body tired. It makes it so much worse when we struggle against it. I don't want to be tired. How can I stop being tired? It's just notice tired. Makes it so much easier. If you recognize that it's maybe not a physical issue, a real need for the body to rest, I suggest also that you don't give up at that point and spend some time investigating the hindrance of sloth and torpor, which is more a mental activity. So in the Satipatthana Sutta, which is the Buddha's main discourse on the four foundations of mindfulness, how to practice, his main instructions for sloth and torpor include this. While sloth and torpor are present in one, one knows there are sloth and torpor present in me. Or while sloth and torpor are not present in one, one knows there is no sloth or torpor present in me. Okay? That's simple. Just noticing. It's what we do with all the hindrances. And so after a while, if we really investigate, we will be able to tell the difference between physical exhaustion, a true need to rest, and the hindrance of sloth and torpor, which is simply making the mind and body feel like sleeping. The difference can be very subtle. And an example of how the mind tricks us with this hindrance, again, to quote the teacher Gil Fronsdale, he explains the presence of sloth and torpor does not mean that the energy is not available. It just means that we're not accessing it. He explains it this way. He says, with a change in conditions, energy may reappear in a moment. This can be seen clearly in young children who switch from being tired while shopping, for instance, to being energetic about an offer of ice cream in a matter of seconds. Right? So you can see it right there. It's not that energy is not available. We're just not accessing it. The Buddha also offers these five things that we should be aware of whenever we notice a hindrance, any of them, such as sloth and torpor. Know when the hindrance is present. That's the hardest part, really, right there. Know that it's present. This is sloth and torpor. Understand the conditions that cause the hindrance to arise. Right? Is it physical or mental? Understand the conditions. What are the conditions? So know when the hindrance is present. Understand the conditions that cause it to arise. The third is know when the hindrance is not present. That's another one. My body's awake. I feel rested. Hindrance isn't here. Understand the conditions that allow the letting go, the release of the hindrance. Right? What helps you to overcome this hindrance? And then understand the conditions necessary to prevent the future arising of the hindrance. Okay? The Buddha taught us all hindrances are self-liberating in the great space of awareness. Right? And finally, as I see, we're almost out of time, and I want to give you a little practice at the end. I want to offer you this gentle encouragement from Anthony Burgess, who tells us, laugh, and the world laughs with you. Snore, and you sleep alone. All right. So I'd like to offer you, just to end, just a brief practice. So if you want to stand and sit again, you can do that. If you're anybody? All right, let's just settle then. I'll offer this. Okay. So just settling. And taking a nice deep breath in. Slow exhale, letting the shoulders drop. Notice where your hands are. See if you can open them a little more. Let go. Not so, so much clinging in the hands. And connecting to the breath. Shoulders dropping, tummy soft. And I'm going to invite you to start noticing the body as a whole. Notice the body in a seated posture here in this space. Notice the breath in the body. And I'm going to invite you to notice if there's any physical sleepiness. Is there any physical sleepiness in the body? And if there's restlessness instead, you might notice that energy. Or maybe if there's a sense of calm, you might notice that sensation. And in all of these, I'd like to invite you to consider these questions. Where might this be living or manifesting in my body? Notice sleepiness. Or any areas that feel tired, maybe. And again, if there's restlessness, notice a lack of tiredness, maybe. Or there can be both. There might be both. You can notice that. Might ask what it really feels like. Is there heaviness? Does it feel like a fog? Or achy? Or light? Or does it come in waves? You might even notice or investigate where it lives in the body. Where do you feel it the most? Is there a place where you feel it, or is it an overall sensation? You could even do a whole body scan where you start at the top of your head and move down to notice. You can ask, might this physical state be affecting the quality of my mind in any way? Our physical state can affect the quality of our mind, and the quality of our mind can affect our physical state. You can ask, what is affecting my body? What is affecting my state of mind? Are they connected? Remembering to breathe. Remembering you're not trying to fix anything, you're just investigating, just noticing. And finally, with the eyes still closed, just listening to these words from Rumi, who tells us, the breezes at dawn have secrets to tell you. Don't go back to sleep. You must ask for what you really want. Don't go back to sleep. People are going back and forth across the door sill where the two worlds touch. The door is round and open. Don't go back to sleep. Okay, thank you everybody. Namaste, namaste. I hope you all get some good sleep tonight.